Thank you for tuning in to CFMU Radio. This is Progressive Voices. I'm Ryan Sparrow.
And I'm Riaz Sanimolji.
Today we are joined by Professor Max Forte from Concordia University. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Professor, do you mind talking a bit about your academic background, sort of research you do?
All right. Well, I'm a professor in anthropology, as you mentioned, at Concordia. My teaching focuses on political anthropology, the new imperialism, indigenous resurgence, and visual and media anthropology.
Okay, so today we're going to be talking about NATO's war in Libya, a lot of recent developments. Professor, I guess we want to start off by asking, what's happening on the ground? There's a lot of contradictory reports coming out right now. Has Gaddafi, has his regime, have they lost Tripoli, and have the rebels gained complete control of the city?
Well, that's a good question, because what's happening on the ground in Libya is, in fact, you know, the question right now. Given, as you mentioned, the fact that we have no consistent reports or verification, and confirmation seem pretty sparse. Journalists are often relying wholly on rebel sources, with all of the obvious shortcomings that entails. And all we can say for certain, you know, at a distance and based on the kind of media that we have, is that the situation is one of extreme confusion and chaos. Some are arguing that that's a great situation for someone like Colonel Gaddafi, because he's a master of working in such an environment, and usually in working in such an environment against much bigger foes as well. So it's hard to say. It's obvious that Gaddafi's government does not seem to be in control of Tripoli and many other cities in Libya. On the other hand, what we do know, with any kind of degree of certainty, and I use that word advisedly, given that the sources do not contradict each other on this point, is that at least two Gaddafi strongholds remain untouched by the rebels. And in fact, they've never once been breached by the rebels since the conflict began. And one of those is Sirte, which is Gaddafi's hometown, and the other is Saba in the south. So the rebels have definitely not gained complete control of the country, and this is something that Russia recognizes and says that it's withholding any kind of formal recognition of the rebels as the government until they can demonstrate that they actually have control of the country.
All right, so if we could talk a bit more about the rebels right now, who are the transitional national council, and do they enjoy popular support amongst the people?
Yeah, also very difficult questions to address. Well, in fact, the Transitional National Council was formed very, very early on. I think it was something like February 27th, so just a mere number of days after the protests began. It's led by a variety of people. Some of the top people were, in fact, in Gaddafi's government. It also involves expatriates who returned to Libya, and we still do not know the identities of nearly half of its executive members. It's centered in Benghazi and eastern Libya, where clearly they do have a lot of support. I'm not sure if they can make similar claims for other parts of Libya, except in those few places where there exist, you know, large concentrations of people from eastern Libya. So it's heavily dominated by interests that are based in eastern Libya. But already what we're hearing, at least from various U.S. military and intelligence analysts who've spoken to the media, and who said that the rebels who've entered entered Tripoli are in fact from western Libya, and they don't necessarily recognize the Transitional National Council as their leadership. So, again, about whether they have popular support, this is a key question. If they did have popular national support, they most likely would not have needed this NATO security blanket, just like some of the truly popular revolutions of the 20th century were not fought by foreign air forces or militaries, but they were won indigenously. So, as a matter of fact, the TNC-associated rebels began to recede and retreat, ironically, once NATO started its campaign. You know, they lost multiple towns and cities that they had overcome before March 19. So this is another question where we're going to have to wait and see just how much popular support they have.
All right, so what are some of the grievances Libyans might have actually had against Gaddafi? And on the contrary, why do you think other parts of Libya did support Gaddafi and may still do?
That is a very complex question for me to address, and actually it's one of those that I would rather defer to someone who's an expert on Libyan politics and Libyan history. What we've been told is that Libya is divided along tribal lines, that the opposition forces are very diverse. It seems clear from statements of the TNC opposition that they want a political system that is not uniformly controlled by Gaddafi, a system under Gaddafi which tolerated very little in the way of dissent. There's a number of complaints that have also come out besides, you know, documented human rights abuses by Gaddafi, arbitrary arrest and detention, torture, and even execution of opponents. In addition to that, his opposition has a number of complaints. You know, clearly some feel that Libya is not a modern country, presumably meaning it doesn't resemble Europe or America enough, that it is not open to the world. You know, I'm not sure what that means because Libya has been actively involved in numerous struggles around the world. There's a resentment towards Gaddafi for reorienting Libya away from the Arab world and toward Africa. You know, how he's provided immense amounts of foreign aid, investment, and other assistance to many nations in Africa and the Caribbean. So this kind of tendency of his toward African integration and African independence was troubling to some of his opponents. The fact that he gave jobs to hundreds of thousands of Africans from sub-Saharan Africa also led to resentment. Among his opponents, there are also the so-called radical Islamists. These are people who have engaged in armed rebellion against the Gaddafi regime in previous years. And in fact, what not many people seem to be aware of or remember is that Gaddafi's war against al-Qaeda predates that of the U.S. by several years. And Libya was the first country to issue an international arrest warrant for bin Laden. So the nature of the grievances are substantial, and they're varied. They're by no means homogeneous.
All right, so I guess moving away from the Libyan perspective, what do you think NATO's interests are in Libya?
That's a good question, because NATO is something we have to remember is that NATO itself is an institution and it has particular institutional interests. You know, its own reproduction and survival are obviously important. Its ability to project power and to win without losing face. It has its credibility is at stake. Some might argue that that's where NATO may have suffered the most in Libya, that only a tiny minority of its 28 member states actually participated in military action against Libya. That was down to 6 towards the end, 6 out of 28. So it has its institutional interests, it has its interests in being seen as a power that can bend countries to the will of the West, wherever they may be, whether or not they have threatened to attack or have actually attacked any NATO member states. All of that is becoming increasingly irrelevant, even though the NATO charter is presumably based on collective self-defense. Clearly, Libya had attacked no NATO member state. When it comes down to individual NATO member states, then obviously we're on to much broader terrain here. The varied interests between Italy, France, the UK, the United States and so forth. So I don't know if you want me to get into that or not.
No, go for it.
Well, the European Union, and Italy especially, has an interest in preventing a mass influx of refugees from Africa. The U.S. military's Africa Command, also known as AFRICOM, has an interest in eliminating or diminishing potential rivals on the African continent. By demolishing the Gaddafi regime, they've gone a step forward towards achieving their aims. In terms of U.S. interests, this is where it gets a bit hazy, because it was the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, along with U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, they both told ABC News at the end of March that Libya represented no vital national interest to the U.S. But clearly, you know, they had interests that remain in terms of large U.S. investments, control over the oil fields, and influencing the course of events in the Middle East and North Africa. The greatest ambiguity, I think, has come from the U.S., or at least from Gates, because in February itself, he had said, with regards to talk about imposing a no-fly zone and that sort of thing, he said, and I'm quoting him, "In my opinion, any future defense secretary who advises a president to again send a big American land army into Asia or into the Middle East or Africa should have his head examined." And those were Gates' words. So I think overall, and especially Italy and France, have the greatest sort of economic interests in Libya. And Italy sources a large proportion of its oil imports from Libya itself.
All right, so what have been the effects of NATO's bombing campaign in Libya?
Well, again, it depends on who we wish to believe. If you want to believe the Gaddafi government spokesperson, the effects have been devastating in terms of the loss of civilian lives and in terms of damage to civilian infrastructure. Now, some of that has, in fact, been documented. It's not entirely myth-making on the part of bizarre spokespersons. The Gaddafi and his government were practically the only institution that was keeping the country together. By demolishing that, they've now opened the door to the kind of disunity and division and conflict that marks places such as Somalia. So the effects of the NATO bombing might end up being extremely severe. Libya's oil production has been, you know, severely curtailed. It's most likely not going to be able to resume oil exports for at least a year or two. And 75% of Libya's revenues come from its oil exports. So you have to ask yourself, where are they going to get the revenues in order to rebuild the country? Obviously, a lot of that is going to have to come in the form of loans and aid. Once you bring that in, you bring in foreign interests and you bring in foreign control. You know, expectations and demands from the people are going to be massive, and if the new government fails to deliver on these on their promises, you know, you can expect a new round of resistance and likely violence.
All right, so given the current situation with the rebels, again, according to sources, poised to take control of the country, do you think Libya will be able to maintain its independence through all this, or has it become a semi-colony?
What seems likely, and I mean, we're now into, well, I haven't counted, actually. This is like the second or third day since the rebels have entered Tripoli. Even so soon, already China has offered to undertake reconstruction. So China's looking after its economic interests. Italy, today is reported that a number of its oil corporations and so forth have made advances to make sure that they have secure access to to Libya. The UK has been making very, especially in the remarks of Foreign Secretary William Hague, very ambiguous remarks that are kind of raising a lot of concern about whether British and other European troops would be sent to Libya to maintain law and order. Some, and to my amazement, this comes from CNN, have said that they're already, right now, at this moment, special forces troops from Britain, France, other European countries, and I think they even mentioned Jordan, that are active in Libya right now in trying to secure rebel control over Libya. So Libya has been sufficiently weakened, divorced from its traditional friends and allies, that to say that it's increasingly becoming an international protectorate, I think is a reasonable thing to conclude.
What effects do you think this war on Libya by NATO will have on the greater geopolitics of Africa and the Middle East?
In terms of Africa, it's obvious that I think AFRICOM is going to be a much greater presence. But the intervention itself sends a very powerful message throughout Africa. And that's that states that wish to be independent, to pursue very different paths, and that on top of everything else even dare to be defiant about it, they're going to find that their internal rule is made impossible. Made impossible by imperial powers that freely arrogate to themselves the right to dictate who can govern in their own country. So it sends a message to Africa in those terms as well. It has managed to sideline African organizations such as the African Union to make them virtually irrelevant, to block them, to effectively block them from any kind of negotiated peace in Libya, and they did that from early on. In terms of the Middle East, it seems clear that to different degrees, I don't want to overstate this, but the U.S. has to different degrees sort of hijacked or tried to hijack various Middle East uprisings, funding opposition groups in some countries, such as Egypt and Syria. This has been amply documented in WikiLeaks. Nobody disputes it. And in other cases, they've helped to stifle opposition groups, such as in Yemen and Bahrain. What's left untouched here is Saudi Arabia and most of the Gulf states, who apparently do not have to answer to the same standards as others. So what people have been calling the Arab Spring, which raised the hopes of so many of us, I would argue is something that ended many months ago, possibly as early as last January.
All right, Max, thanks again for doing this interview. It was very informative. I just wanted to end off by asking, is there like a website or an email my listeners can reach you at?
Sure. I can be reached at Open Anthropology. That's one word, openanthropology.org.
All right, perfect. And Max, thanks again. This was great.
Thank you very much. It was really my pleasure to speak with you.